We're going to look at a passage out of Luke today about a fool. So let me read you a story about a fool. There's different kinds of fools. Sometimes all of us have felt foolish because we made some kind of decision or some kind of mistake that made us feel foolish, but that doesn't necessarily make you a fool. There are people, though, who are actually a fool, and Proverbs has several different descriptions of those. A greedy man would be a fool. A selfish man would be a fool. An impertinent man, the know-it-all, the person who knows everything. You can't tell them anything. They already know it. But they go out and do the wrong thing, and they wouldn't listen. Kind of like there's a sign right there that says, don't drive through. The bridge is out. And the guy says, I'm driving through here. Nobody's going to tell me. And he drives into the river. That's a fool. So here's a little story about a fool. It says, this story won first place in a recent criminal lawyers contest for most unusual and unbelievable stories. A Charlotte, North Carolina lawyer purchased a box of very rare and expensive cigars. He then insured them against fire, among other things. Within a month, having smoked his entire stockpile of these 24 great cigars, and yet without having made his first premium payment on the policy, he filed a claim against the insurance company. In his claim, this lawyer stated the cigars were lost in a series of small fires. The insurance company refused to pay, citing the reason being that the man had consumed the cigars in the normal fashion, and that was obvious. The lawyer sued and won. In delivering the ruling, the judge agreed with the insurance company that the claim was frivolous. The judge stated, nevertheless, that the lawyer held a policy from the company in which it had warranted that the cigars were insurable and also guaranteed that it would insure them against fire without defining what is acceptable fire and was therefore obligated to pay the claim. Rather than endure a lengthy and costly appeal process, the insurance company accepted the ruling and paid $15,000 to the lawyer for his loss of the rare cigars that was lost in the fires. After the lawyer cashed the check, the insurance company had him arrested on 24 counts of arson, with his own insurance claim and testimony from the previous case being used against him. The lawyer was convicted of intentionally burning his insured property. He was sentenced to 24 months in jail and $24,000 fine. That's a fool who thought he was smarter than the insurance company and the judge. So today we actually look at a passage where Jesus actually calls someone a fool. Now, if Jesus calls somebody a fool, I would like to know the context. Why would Jesus say a person is a fool? There's something to learn from this story. So let's read the passage. I'm reading from Luke chapter 12, verses 13 through 21. Someone in the crowd said to him, "Teacher, tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me." Jesus replied, "Man, who appointed me a judge or an arbiter between you?" Then he said to them, "Watch out, be on your guard against all kinds of greed. A man's life does not consist in the abundance of his possessions." And he told them this parable. The ground of a certain rich man produced a good crop. He thought to himself, "What shall I do? I have no place to store my crops." Then he said, "This is what I'll do. I'll tear down my barns and build bigger ones. And there I will store all my grain and my goods. And I'll say to myself, you have plenty of good things laid up for many years. Take life easy, eat, drink, and be merry." But God said to him, "You fool, this very night your life will be demanded from you. Then who will get what you have prepared for yourself? This is how it will be with anyone who stores up things for himself, but is not rich toward God." Now, there's two fools in the story. The first one is an individual that we don't even know who he is. He's just one of these guys who interrupts the conversation. He interrupts the flow of everything. He's obnoxious. He's impertinent. He's a pest. He's the guy who says in verse 13, someone in the crowd says, "Teacher, tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me." Don't you hate it when someone comes up to you? They don't talk to you, then they just start telling you what to do. This is what you should do. And they start just telling you what to do. Well, this guy comes out of nowhere and starts telling Jesus to tell his brother. He's actually demanding, tell my brother he should give my part of the inheritance to me. Evidently, the brother knew who he was and wasn't cooperating. Jesus isn't about to be swallowed up in this arbitrary mess, and he makes it very clear by calling the man. Jesus is declaring he will have no part of it. He says, who appointed me a judge or an arbiter between you? Jesus never came to be the judge. He will one day come to be the judge, but not when he came to be Savior. And that's it, as far as the guy is concerned, this guy who blurted out. But Jesus didn't like his rudeness, but he used the opportunity to give a warning. And the warning was to the man, but also a warning to all of us. A warning we should take to heart. A warning against one of the most diabolical forces known to human beings on this earth. Do you have an idea what it is? It starts with a G. It's greed. I call it the green monster. The green monster who gobbles people up. And do you know how you actually fight against the green monster? You fight with another word, and it starts with a G also. It's called generosity. When you're generous, you pound the green monster away. When you stop being generous, when you stop being grateful, when you stop giving, thinking of others, greed takes over. It changes your perspective. It changes who you are. It blinds you to the fact that God gave you what you have in the first place. I love the story of Hosea. Someday I'm going to teach the book of Hosea. I haven't done that yet on Sunday mornings. But that Hosea is married to a wife named Gomer, and she was very unfaithful. Hosea should have been the one unfaithful with the wife named Gomer, but she was very unfaithful to him. And she was living this life of infidelity, and Hosea would go and take food and money and leave it for her, and she would come and find it and take it. And the scripture says she would pick up the food and the money and go and had no idea where it came from. Hosea was giving it to her. And she never even occurred to her that this faithful husband was providing for her even when she was away from him. That's the way God is with us. And greed blinds us to the fact that God gives us life every day. And here's the warning in verse 15. Then he said to them, watch out. You know what it's like when somebody says watch out because somebody's about to hit you or you're in the way of, watch out. And Jesus is saying, watch out for greed. Get out of the way. Be on your guard against all kinds of greed. A man's life does not consist in the abundance of his possessions. Greed is so powerful that it is the 10th commandment. Let's look at it. Exodus chapter 20, verse 17, where the 10 commandments are listed, and this is the last one. You shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife or his maidservant, manservant, maidservant, his ox or donkey or anything that belongs to your neighbor. And the book of Proverbs divides greed from generosity. There's just tons of verses in the book of Proverbs. Here are a few. Proverbs 21:26. All day long he craves for more. That's the greedy person. There's never enough. He gets this thing, and then as soon as he gets it, what's he want? Something else. But listen to the generous, but the righteous give without sparing. What a contrast. Paul wrote to the Ephesians about greed. But among you there must not be even a hint of sexual immorality or any kind of impurity or greed, because these are improper for God's holy people. When he addressed the elders in Ephesus in Acts 20, in this very, very emotional setting, Paul said, I have not coveted anyone's silver or gold or clothing. To the Colossians, he wrote, put to death, therefore, whatever belongs to your earthly nature, sexual immorality, impurity, lust, evil desires, and greed, which is idolatry, which is very interesting because greed is on the level of worshiping another god. You've made money a god. It's a dead-end pursuit. Greed yields no satisfaction. It brings no fulfillment. Ecclesiastes says this, whoever loves money never has money enough. Whoever loves wealth is never satisfied with his income. This too is meaningless. When Paul wrote Timothy, he told him to teach the people about the dangers of greed. For the love of money is the root of all kinds of evil. Now, did you hear that? You know, that's the most misquoted verse in the Bible. What do people usually who don't know the Bible, how do they read this? They say that money is the root of all evil, but it doesn't say that. There's nothing. Money is neutral. It's not money that is evil. I mean, the bills may be dirty, but they don't have anything to do with it. It is the love of money that is evil. Some people eager for money have wandered from the faith and pierced themselves with many griefs. So we are to guard ourselves against this. Then Jesus gives us a principle. The principles that are found in the Bible are how we live our lives. When you're taking a road trip, we recently drove to California and back. You cross 5 states to get out there. And when you're driving across states like Texas, New Mexico, Arizona, you need a sign every once in a while that tells you how far to the next town. And it kind of helps you because it's like, I mean, shouldn't this town be coming somewhere? Did somebody pick it up and steal it? I mean, where? And then the sign comes and it tells you, you know, like 100 miles. Okay, 100 miles. Now I know it's an hour and a half. I'm going to, you know, make it to this next town. Well, principles are like that. They help us to live our lives. They tell us, all right, this is the direction you need to live. This next principle is a guiding principle for handling money in our lives. And it is a biblical principle. Here it is from Jesus. Verse 15, watch out, be on your guard against all kinds of greed. A man's life does not consist in the abundance of his possessions. That's it. A man's life does not consist in the abundance of his possessions. That's a principle. I want to read to you a paragraph from Kent Hughes. He's one of the authors of a commentary I referred to. He pastored in Chicago for many, many years, and when he was writing on this passage, he wrote this paragraph. I grew up in the 1950s, graduating from high school in 1959. I remember my friend Richard Smith's 57 Chevy with idolatrous accuracy. Richard lived 3 doors down the street from me and was 4 years older than the rest of us. That Chevy was so beautiful, Campbell Soup red. Its fins sided with a gorgeous swath of etched chrome, its dual exhausts rumbling with a big Chevy V8, with white Angora-covered dies hanging from the rearview mirror. And Richard made such a cool profile behind the wheel. His perfect flat-top haircut, his arm hung nonchalantly over the wheel, his imperial nod as he floated by. After school in the spring, when my buddies and I played basketball in the street, Richard Smith would drive home from work, his fine Chevrolet gleaming, and we stood aside reverently as he passed by. I was sure that life consisted, if not in the abundance of possession, at least in one possession, a 1957 Chevrolet Bel Air Coupe. If I owned one of those, I would be significant, important, and certainly cool. It's amazing how 57 Chevrolet may have been the ultimate for those heirs, but there's always something that has the pull for every generation. But Jesus says, life, those things are necessary, but life does not consist in those things, your clothes, your house, your money, your wealth. And if you think it does, you're wrong. This is Jesus, the one who is saying that. They won't make us happy. They won't make us contented. And we're utterly foolish to pursue life from a material fashion. So Jesus follows that principle with a parable. And Jesus told about 50 parables. We love his stories. They're made-up stories. And I like stories. And I like Jesus' stories the best. I make up my own stories, modeling from Jesus. I try to learn from him. But stories help us to learn things. And Jesus tells us stories to help us see. And parables always take two things and they compare. So in this story, we're looking at the principle. The principle is, if you really want to understand life, it's not about money. It's not about how much you have. It's not about how big the barns are, how big the crop was, how fat is the checkbook, how much money you got in the bank, how many stocks you have, how big your house is, how many designer clothes you have. It's not about possessions. And so Jesus states that, and now he tells us a story. Here's the story. We read it once. Remember, I deliberately read more than once because I want you to understand these things. The ground of a certain rich man produced a good crop. So it wouldn't be good if the man, obviously, to have a good crop. I come from farming country. There's a lot of things to say for that. First of all, there's a lot of hard work went into that. But there's a lot of things beyond his control. He had to have good soil. He had to have good seed. He had to have a lot of good sun. He had to have water. He had to have the absence of pestilence and disease. And then he has a good crop. He thought to himself, "What shall I do? I have no place to store my crops." Then he said, "This is what I'll do. I'll tear down my barns and build bigger ones. And there I will store all my grain and my goods. And I'll say to myself, you have plenty of good things laid up for many years. Take life easy. Eat, drink, and be merry." Now, we say that this is foolish reasoning on the part of this farmer. Why? I mean, he's very successful, prosperous. Does the Bible have something against wealth? Not at all. Abraham was wealthy. Isaac was wealthy. Jacob was wealthy. Martha and Mary were quite wealthy that took care of Jesus. The centurion in the Bible who had his servant healed and built a synagogue, he was wealthy. Lots of wealthy people in the Bible. So it's not about the wealth that the man had. What is so foolish about his reasoning? It's in verse 19 we get the clue. "And I'll say to myself," this is self-talk. He might not even be going around telling everybody this. This is what he says to himself. He says, "You have plenty of good things laid up for many years. Take life easy. Eat, drink, and be merry." This is a hedonistic attitude. There's no thought of God. There's no thought of others. There's no thought of life. This is a fool talking here. Life is fragile. Life is short. It's a gift from God. Life is eternal. It's not just temporal. But this very foolish reasoning is if there could be nothing bad to him. As if tomorrow is guaranteed. In the book of James, it actually says, when you refer to tomorrow, you should actually say, "The Lord willing." If I'm here tomorrow, I'm going to Cincinnati, I'm going to Indianapolis, I'm going to Springfield. The Lord willing, why should we think like that? Because we don't own tomorrow. But this guy acts as if he does. And he acts as if there's nothing that could interfere with his plans. This hedonistic attitude is found in the Bible. Solomon wrote about it in chapter 8, verse 15 of Ecclesiastes. "So I commend the enjoyment of life, because nothing is better for a man under the sun than to eat and drink and be glad. Then joy will accompany him in his work all the days of his life God has given him under the sun." Solomon is saying there's nothing wrong with enjoying your work. But if you are consumed with your possessions, there is something wrong with it. What he didn't have was the proper fear of God that just a few weeks ago we talked about. Jesus talked about that all of us should have a proper fear of God. Let me remind you, that's in the same chapter in Luke. This is Jesus speaking here. "I tell you, my friends, do not be afraid of those who kill the body and after that can do no more. But I will show you whom you should fear. Fear him who after the killing of the body has power to throw you into hell. Yes, I say, fear him." And that's why the book of Proverbs says that wisdom actually begins with the fear of God. Here it is, Proverbs 1:7. "The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom." He didn't have it. Charlie Shedd, he's written a book. And he has a little story in this book that I like. He says, we moved from Nebraska to Oklahoma. When we moved from Nebraska to Oklahoma, we brought binder twine. That's what you find on a bale of hay and either use wire or twine. In this case, twine. I had used it there to tie sacks of feed and miscellaneous items. It cost me about $1.15. So I said, now, Philip, you see this binder twine? That's his little son. I want you to leave it alone. But it held a strange fascination for him, and he began to use it anytime he wanted. I would say, don't, no, you can't. But all to no avail. This went on for 6 or 8 months. Then one day I came home tired. There was the garage looking like no man's land with binder twine this way, that way, up and down. I had to cut my way through it to get to the car. And I was provoked. I ground my teeth as I slashed at the binder twine. Suddenly, when I was halfway through the maze, a light dawned. And I asked myself, why do you want the binder twine, Charlie? What if Philip does use it? So when I went to supper that night, Philip was there and I began, say about the binder twine. He hung his head and mumbled, yes, Daddy. Then I said, Philip, I've changed my mind. You can use that old binder twine anytime you want. What's more, all those tools out there in the garage I've labeled no, you can go ahead and use them. I can buy new tools, but I can't buy new boys. There never was a surprise like that smile. Thanks, Daddy, he beamed. And guess what? He never touched the binder twine again. Binder twine. $1. And you're going to fight over binder twine? Anybody who knows the Bible knows that we should be good stewards. But things just don't matter when it comes to people. People are more important than things. When we were building the chapel, which this church, some guys from this church helped us build a chapel at the Bible school in Cordova, and we put big beams up there, and they were metal beams, and we made them look like wood. Turned out real nice. And the day we were putting those beams up there, we had to do a lot of bolting. And so I had 3 ratchets, and we had 1,000 nuts and bolts to do, and the Argentine guys were throwing these ratchets between them. And then just catch them, throw it to the next guy. Well, one of those, every once in a while, one would fall, you know, about 30 feet down on the concrete, and it got broke. So one of the guys that was kind of in charge, he come running over to me with this broken ratchet, and he said, we're going to have to stop this throwing the ratchets up there. This one is broke. I said, let them throw them. We'll buy more ratchets. What is so interesting is how this little nature rises up. And he said, the guy said to me, how are we going to pay for this? And I said, we'll take it out of the ratchet fund. God called this man a fool. And that's pretty serious. Look, verse 20. But God said to him, you fool. Whew. You don't find that too often in the Bible. If God's going to call somebody a fool because they are making more out of their money than they are out about people, and because they forgot God and forgot people, and God says you're a fool, I want to look at it twice. This very night your life will be demanded from you, then you will get what you have prepared for yourself. As I mentioned, he forgot life is fragile. It takes insight and understanding in life to see how fragile it is. What we think is so permanent can change just like that. Life is so short. I told you last week, I walked in my folks' house and there's those 2 recliners. Empty. Because life is short. That life is a gift from God and we're not the owners. He is. And life is for eternity. It's not just for now. I remember listening to, I've listened to Dr. Dobson for like 35 years. first on Focus on the Family and now on Family Talk. And years ago, he read this story from what he said was his favorite book. Well, I eventually got the book. If somebody has a, if Dobson has a favorite book, I buy it. If Swindoll has a favorite book, I buy it. So I have met a lot of people by listening to what is a good book. So this book was by a doctor named Richard Chelsier. And Dobson said, this wasn't necessarily a Christian book. This is just a very interesting life story. This doctor, he had a very busy practice. He was actually a young man. And every once in a while, because his practice was so busy, he would just go over to a public library and just pick up a book and read. And he learned that it helped him to get away from the office. Just for an extended lunch hour or whatever, kind of refresh his mind and think that there's more to life than just work. And so he would usually do this every Wednesday. And in this library, he met several people. They were aged people who had a lot of problems. There was people he gave pet names to. There was Old Stovepipe, Mrs. Fringes, Neckerchief, Gloshers. Neckerchief became his favorite. He moved around with short steps. He would point to his knees and say, "The hinges are pretty rusty." When asked why he limped, he pointed to his toes. "The toenails are too long and I can't cut them anymore, so I have to walk on them." The day Dr. Seltzer saw that, he went right back to his office. The doctor went back to his office and collected his clippers and said he would be at the library for a while. The nurse said, "Well, I guess folks are not supposed to get sick on Wednesday, right?" Dr. Seltzer took Neckerchief to the bathroom and seated him on the stool and went to work on the toes. He spent an hour on each one. They were so bad. Someone else occupied twice the booth next door while he was working on Neckerchief. I asked Neckerchief if it hurt, to which he replied, "It don't hurt," and he gave me a big smile. I'll keep in my safety deposit box. Then the doctor did Stovepipe and Mrs. Fringes. Now, why in the world would a doctor from a successful practice take time to go cut toenails for somebody who doesn't matter? Somebody whose life doesn't consist in the abundance of their possessions. Jesus says in verse 21, this is how it will be with anyone, this is you and me, who stores up things for himself but is not rich toward God. How foolish to miss the riches of knowing and loving God. This is a warning to us. How to miss that he's the creator of this beautiful universe. How sad it is to miss the fact that God created people who are the apple of his eye and they're all unique, all special. How sad it is to miss the richness of family and to know the joy of actually being loved and loving someone. But these are things money can't buy. So how about your portfolio? How's it look? I'm not talking about the money one. I'm talking about your heavenly portfolio. There's nothing wrong with retire. This, incidentally, is the only place in the Bible that ever talks about retirement right here, and it's actually not in a good context. The Bible isn't against retirement or slowing down, but it's against forgetting who God is. That was the foolish part here. Psalm 50, verse 10 says, "For every animal on the forest is mine, and the cattle on a thousand hills." What's that little verse mean? What in the world does that mean? That means that God owns it all. And we are his stewards. He's the owner and we're the stewards. That changes how you look at money. Actually, a sermon like this, a passage like this, if you let it, could actually wake you up and change the way you look at money. It could make you more generous. Let me ask you, when you write out your tithe check or you put cash, whatever, does it hurt or does it feel good? Don't raise your hand. If it's still hurting, you know, like, man, do I really have, should I really give that much? You know, I actually paid a little bit too much last week. I could, I'm going to cut that down. And week before that, I could cut it down to half. You're battling the green monster. Just give it. Just give it. Listen to this. The British novelist and playwright David Lodge was watching one of his own creations, a satirical review, the evening of November 22nd, 1963. The theater audience chuckled as an actor in the play showed up for a job interview with a transistor radio clutched to his ear. Demonstrating the character's blasé indifference, the actor then set down the radio and tuned it to a station, letting its news, music, or commercials play in the background while the play went on. That night, however, a voice came on the radio with a live news bulletin. Today, the American president, John F. Kennedy, was assassinated. The audience gasped, and the actor immediately switched off the radio, but it was too late. In one sentence, the reality of the outside world had shattered the artificial world of the theater production. Suddenly, whatever action took place on stage seemed superficial and irrelevant. If you let Jesus' warning and this principle really get inside, it'll shatter this superficial world that we get in, because the world tells you the most important thing is your things. It's not true. It's not true. You ever see a hearse on the way to cemetery with a U-Haul trailer? There's no need to even put pockets on the suit. You can't take anything with you. It's all left for somebody else. It's people. It's God. Nothing wrong with preparing. Nothing wrong with being prudent, as long as we don't get lost along the way. So let me close with this verse. That's why verses like this appear in the Pentateuch, which God intended for Israel to comprehend. So they were on a journey, and they were going to this promised land. And when they got there, God wanted them to have a mindset, and here is the mindset. When you have eaten and are satisfied, praise the Lord your God for the good land he has given you. Be careful that you do not forget the Lord your God, failing to observe his commands, his laws, and his decrees that I am giving you this day. Otherwise, when you eat and are satisfied, when you build fine houses and settle down, when your herds and flocks grow large and your silver and gold increase, and all you have is multiplied, then your heart will become proud and you will forget the Lord your God. That's foolish. Who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. He led you through the vast and dreadful desert, that thirsty, waterless land with its venomous snakes and scorpions. He brought you water out of hard rock. He gave you manna to eat in the desert, something your fathers had never known, to humble and to test you, so that in the end it might go well with you.